So if you look at the last 30 years of data, self-storage has actually had the highest return compared to any other asset class. So for example, over the last 30 years, the S&P 500 returned about 7.5%. Multifamily did a little bit better at about 13%. Self-storage was at 17.4%. So now that 4% doesn't seem like a lot, but you got to realize that's compounding year over year. So if you had $100,000 to invest 30 years ago, if you put it into apartment buildings, you'd have about 1.7 million today. If you put it into self-storage, you'd have a little over 4 million. So double the return of what you'd have in apartments.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Fernando Angelucci is the president of Titan Wealth Group, and he's built a portfolio of more than $100 million in self-storage assets within the last 3 years, and he diversified his investments by purchasing existing cash-flowing assets and also building ground-up facilities. Fernando, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. Same few questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you very quickly tell us, maybe in like 90 seconds or less, where'd you start, where are you now, and how'd you get there?
Yeah, so started off by reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad when I was 16 years old. Eventually started investing in single family, multifamily properties, scaling that up. In 2016, I was kind of getting tired of the way the government's kind of socializing our rental housing. So I sold off all of my rental holdings and started investing in storage. And we just crossed over $100 million in assets, building that up starting in end of 2018.
Wow. So in 2016, you sold everything off and you said, all right, I'm out. And you briefly said it there, just the socialization of housing and things along those lines that can make it challenging. What were some of the signposts that made you say, okay, I'm finally done?
Yeah. So a majority of my portfolio was in Chicago. So Chicago in itself starting to take after the New York cities and the San Franciscos of the world as far as housing laws. They view landlords as these big evil conglomerates that are just full of money bags, when little does the government know, like 85% of landlords are like two or three payments ahead on the mortgage compared to the rent that they're receiving.
Right.
So to say, hey, tenants don't have to pay rent, but then landlords still have to pay their mortgage and property taxes, now you're causing a lot of this middle class to default and really mess up their credit and their financial future. I didn't like the way that was going. So decided to sell off all of my, what I call habitation real estate. I don't want people living in my investments anymore. And that's when we started buying self-storage. Slow at first, buying kind of mom and pop stuff, and then start building these class A REIT grade facilities towards the end.
Have you found anybody living in their self-storage units yet?
Actually, we have. So there was a facility that we bought in Tennessee. And like 2 days after we bought it, a friend of mine sent me an article talking about, I was like, hey, does this ever happen in your facilities? And it was like a man and a child living in one of the units. And I scrolled down the article and lo and behold, the facility I had bought 2 days prior. So called the manager and said, hey, I don't know if you know about this or not, but you need to get these people out. This is illegal. They're not allowed to live there. And why are you allowing a one-year-old child to live in one of your units? So we had them removed and connected them with the proper social services.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I kind of asked that question tongue in cheek, just in the sense that I think inevitably when you get into the real estate business, the stories are innumerable of the strange things that can happen. So that does not strike me by surprise at all. What are some of the other advantages as you've gotten into self-storage that made you say, okay, this is the asset class I want to be in, and why?
Yeah. So if you look at the last 30 years of data, self-storage has actually had the highest return compared to any other asset class. So for example, over the last 30 years, the S&P 500 returned about 7.5%. Multifamily did a little bit better at about 13%. Self-storage was at 17.4%. So now that 4% doesn't seem like a lot, but you got to realize that's compounding year over year. So if you had $100,000 to invest 30 years ago, if you put it into apartment buildings, you'd have about 1.7 million today. If you put it into self-storage, you'd have a little over 4 million. So double the return of what you'd have in apartments. Now people say, well, okay, if the return is so great, that must mean that the risks are also commensurate to the returns. And actually, that's not the case. So if you look at the last two major recessions we went through, 2007 to 2009, self-storage only dropped about 3.5% in value, whereas the S&P dropped 22%. Multifamily dropped about 7 to 8%. And then if you look at the most recent recession, which is the pandemic, TREP, which is a commercial mortgage-backed securities research firm, found that of the 1,700 CMBS loans that were made to self-storage investors in the first three quarters of the pandemic, only three were delinquent. That's a 0.17% delinquency rate. During that same time, multifamily was defaulting at a rate of 1,800% higher, or 18 times the default rate of self-storage.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. What are some of the things you feel like that attribute to that very low number?
Yeah, absolutely. So the nice thing about self-storage is that it's a very cash flow rich business. So when you look at like break-even occupancies, when I had multifamily properties, I'd have to stay about 80 to 85% occupied, or else I wasn't going to be able to pay my expenses and my mortgage. With self-storage, when they're leveraged, as long as I'm above like 64% occupancy, I'm cash flow positive after debt service. So right there, you have a cushion of about 20% that you wouldn't have in multifamily. The second piece is that you have evictions in multifamily, whereas in self-storage, you have auctions. We actually aren't guided by tenant landlord law. We're actually guided by lien law. So I'll give you an example of one of my multifamily properties in Chicago. I bought a property. It came with a tenant that wasn't paying. The tenant refused to leave, and they were what I call a professional tenant. So they knew all the tips and tricks. They would pull out all the smoke alarms and the carbon monoxide detectors right before an inspector would come through and get the eviction pushed, pushed, and pushed. And eventually, it took me 8.5 months to get that tenant out. And before they were actually removed by the sheriff, they caused over $25,000 of damage on that one unit by cutting electrical lines and pouring Kwikset concrete down the toilet. So caused some serious damage. In storage with lien law, if you don't pay me within the 5-day grace period, I send you an auction notice. And if you still don't pay during that auction period where the notice is active, I overlock your unit. So you don't even have access to your possessions. You can't even get into the self-storage facility. And within that 45 days, if you don't pay me, I sell off all your stuff on kind of like an eBay style auction online that returns all of the lost rent that I had experienced. And it also allows me to charge a bunch of fees, like a lien fee, late payment fee, auction fee. So I actually make somewhat of a profit on that. It's not a real profit book. According to our accounting, it's a net zero. But then usually our new tenant meets the auction buyer who has to clean out the unit or else they lose their deposit. And then I have a new tenant in place and I never lose a step. There's not really anything you can damage because all of my buildings are made out of steel and concrete. So you can't really do much to them on the side of turnover or repair costs. So that's another piece. And then the last piece I'd say is the fact that we have not only a very high sticky factor, but we also are an industry that serves people in transition. So when the economy is doing well, people are buying a bunch of things. They usually buy more things than they have to store. So they end up putting things in storage, or they're maybe moving, they sell their house and they decide to upgrade to a larger home. They need to use our services, or maybe they're getting a new job that pays better and they're moving to another location. That's another use of storage. When the economy is doing bad, for example, people are typically downsizing. So they're going ahead and using storage again, changing jobs. And then storage, where we get most of our demand comes from the two largest generations. So the greatest generation / baby boomers, they're retiring at a clip of like 15 to 18,000 people per day. And on the older end of that generation, they're going into assisted living facilities and they're not getting rid of all their stuff. They're putting it in storage. Now, a lot of assisted living facilities actually require that you show proof that you have a storage unit for the possessions of the person that's going into the facility. On the opposite side of the generational divide, you have kind of the millennials and the Gen Xers. They don't want to live in the suburbs anymore. They want to live downtown next to the action, the nightlife, the restaurants, and they're opting for smaller living conditions like a 700, maybe 900 square foot apartment right in the middle of the action in a high rise, and then using storage as an external closet for their hiking gear, their biking gear, their seasonal wardrobes, things like that. So storage has always been in demand. It's growing in demand right now. 1 in 10 households use storage at the moment, and that number has been growing year over year for the last 30 years or so.
Wow. Thanks for breaking down the kind of demand side of that business. You said something earlier I want to circle back on. Just going back to the way that you do lien law and how you said the new tenant meets the auction buyer. What did that mean?
Yeah. So that we have as little interruption as possible. On most of our self-storage facilities, we have a wait list of people that want to get in. So specifically for the really popular units, which are the 10 by 10, the 10 by 15, and the 10 by 20, it's a little bit larger units. So when an auction buyer makes a bid on one of these self-storage facilities or these units, it's not like the TV show. It's not like Storage Wars. That's totally staged, and it's actually extremely inefficient way to do auctions.
Right.
So nowadays it's like eBay. So our manager will take a photo of the unit, take as many photos as they can without breaking the barrier. And they'd put that up on these storage auction sites. And somebody would make a bid and say, hey, I'm willing to pay $500 for this unit. If they win the bid, in addition to the $500, they also have to put up a $100 cleaning deposit, which means that after they clean out all the possessions of that unit, they have to not only completely empty it, but they have to broom sweep that unit. And if they don't do that, they lose that $100 deposit.
Right.
So what I usually do is I'll have one of the new tenants that was on the wait list waiting for that unit actually meet the storage buyer there, so that once the storage buyer is done cleaning out the unit, then they are ready to move in same day. And then that way I have no disruption in rent.
Right. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. Let's shift gears. Thanks for breaking that down, because I didn't quite follow that. I mean, and that's a brilliant model. I mean, if you have zero vacancy, I guess maybe you got 45 days or whatever it is of time when that tenant hasn't been paying, but hopefully you're recouping most of that via the auction. Let's talk about that actually for a second. That brings up another question. I mean, anybody that's interested in these auctions has to be within a certain radius of where that facility is located to even be interested in an auction taking place. Is that correct or no?
You'd assume, but we've had some crazy buyers here. So as soon as they win the bid on the auction, depending on the state, they have anywhere between 48 hours to 7 days to come and collect the possessions. And we've had people drive across state lines for some of these, especially the bigger units. They have a bunch of boxes and they don't know what could be in there. They're hunting for gold, I guess.
Right.
So we'll have people from all over the place bid on these things.
How do you protect yourselves from a really challenging auction? Let's say that the owner of the goods come back and then they try to sue you guys or throw a fit or threaten your people working there. I mean, that just sounds like a recipe for disaster. How do you work around that?
Yeah. So luckily, the way that all the state laws are written, the compiled statutes are completely in the self-storage owner's favor as long as we follow all the rules. So we just follow all the laws to a T. Biggest thing is we send auction notice to the owner of that unit. We also post it on their unit as well as on the facility itself. And then we put a notice into a local circulatory, so like a legal newspaper, and we run that ad twice, spaced by 1 or 2 weeks at a time. And it says, here's the date of the auction. Here's the unit we're auctioning off. Here's the address of the location. You have until this date to come completely current on your unit, or else it's going to be sold. And the law protects us in allowing us to do that. Now, we typically try to work with the tenant at first. So before we get to that point, we'll try to give them phone calls, emails, text messages saying, hey, you're late. Do you want to jump on a payment plan? Do you want to figure this out? And typically what happens is they just ghost us. They kind of put their head in the sand. They don't answer any of our calls, texts, email addresses, anything. And so then we go through the auction process.
That makes a heck of a lot of sense. Let's talk about a value add, what it looks like in storage, but even more than that, storage is becoming a very competitive landscape. I mean, it's a hot commodity, as in a lot of commercial real estate is, but there's a lot of interest, especially from an institutional side of things in the self-storage industry. How are you guys finding opportunity? And then what does value add look like inside of those opportunities?
Yeah. So let me kind of start backwards from your question. So the institutional buyers, those are our target audience, right? Every time we're doing value add or every time we're building facilities to sell them, if we're not hold them long-term, we're looking to get institutional buyers in place. And the reason we like working with them is typically they're all numbers driven. There's no emotions involved, like you'd see typically in single family homes or small multifamily. They are cash flush. The majority of our properties are bought either 100% cash within 30 days or 50% leverage. So really strong buyers. And what we've noticed is the institutions, they typically like to outlay larger checks if possible. So they're not really interested in things below like 80,000 square feet. There's some that'll go down to 65, but for the most part, they want to be in that 80,000 plus square footage up to anywhere between, if it's a single property, up to like 140, 150,000 net rentable square feet. If it's a portfolio of property, then the buyers really start getting interested after about the $10 to $20 million strike price is where you're going to be seeing some really good cap rate compression on the buy side. So what we do is we have three main verticals. The first vertical is we buy existing mom and pop facilities. So these are typically facilities that are not being run very well. The owner is not very sophisticated. This is maybe a second business, a third business, retired once or twice before, and they're cutting deals for friends, things like that. So we'll come in and on those properties, we'll right off the bat create a marketing plan because typically they're not listed on Google. They don't have any advertising. They don't have a website. We'll go in and we'll raise all the fees up to the statutory limit. We'll also raise all of the rents to the market. So we'll come in, do a competitor study, seeing what the similar properties in the area are charging, and then raise our rents. That's usually one of the biggest value adds we can do. Typically, when we buy these mom and pop facilities, they're anywhere between 25 to 40% below market.
Wow.
We'll go ahead and auction off any units that are just sitting there. What we find is a lot of these mom and pop facilities, they'll just let people not pay for 1, 2, 3 years and think that they're somehow going to get that money back eventually. Never happens. And then we'll start doing CapEx style value add. So that's going to be putting in automatic gates, keypad entry and exit, putting in cameras, security lights, kiosks, which allow you to automatically rent a unit without even having to interact with a person, which lowers our labor cost. And then we'll actually put in additional units. So we'll expand the facilities either with permanent structures, or if we don't have room for permanent structures or there's easements or setbacks, then we'll use these modular units that are movable with forklifts. So that's what we kind of do on the existing side. And then what we'll do to get those ready for institutional buyers is that we'll start putting them together into large portfolios. So we'll take 5, 6, 7, 10 of these facilities and wrap them together. We're actually doing that right now. We're selling a portfolio of 10 of these smaller facilities to an institutional buyer at the moment. To get to that point, what we found is that in storage, the leverage available to us is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, you can go get an SBA loan and get a 10% down loan on a 25-year fully ammed loan. That's unheard of in the multifamily space, right? And the rates are in the mid to high threes, maybe low 4%. Once you get to the institutional side of the debt stack or the CMBS markets, that's when you start getting some really good terms where you can get a 10-year balloon on a 30-year am in the 2.5% to 3% interest range. You can get all 10 years interest only, and those loans are non-recourse, which are fantastic, right? So that's kind of the small side of the business. Then you got the large side. The reason we started developing these Class A large facilities is because we found that once we started getting between that 65 to 80,000 square foot range, we kept getting beat out by what we thought were insane offers. These 4% cap rate, these 4.5% cap rate, when we're typically buying these things at 9 caps. And then what we realize is now we're competing against a more sophisticated buyer that has basically free money. So the only way to compete against them on those is just to build them. So we control the deal, right? Never have to compete on them. So what we start doing is you buy 4 to 10 acre plots of land, and then we'll put up these 100 to 150,000 net rentable square foot buildings. They're typically Class A, REIT grade. They're 3 stories tall, state-of-the-art technology and security. They look beautiful, well-landscaped, things like that. And those ones, they cost us about $10 to $12 million to build. We can typically build them at anywhere between $95 to $110 bucks a foot. And then we sell them off for anywhere between $18 to $25 million. Within 1 to 5 years of us building them. So we're able to usually double our investors' capital within 1 to 5 years.
That's fantastic. I love that. There's a lot of moving pieces there, and I wish we had more time to dig in, especially on the ground-up development side of things. That's fantastic. I love what you're doing, Fernando. This has been awesome. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show today. Explosive growth, and I look forward to seeing where you guys go in the self-storage space the next few years. Here's a few final questions as we wrap up the show. The first one is this: what is one tool or resource that you find you can't live without?
Yeah, this may be a cop-out answer, but if you've never read Traction by Gino Wickman, that is one of the best books to help you scale your business. We love it so much that we've actually hired EOS certified integrators to come in and implement the EOS process into our business. And that's how we were able to go from a $1 million facility up to $100 million of property in about 3 years.
That's awesome. I love that. Great. Second question. What is one mistake in real estate you could help our listeners avoid? And then how would you avoid it?
Due diligence, due diligence, due diligence, due diligence, due diligence. Go see the property. Pay third-party advisors. Get an environmental assessment. Get a civil engineer to do a property condition assessment. Get your lender to put eyes on the property. I mean, I cannot stress the amount of due diligence that is needed. As long as you do everything right up front, the rest is easy.
The rest is easy. Man, I love that. Third question for you is this. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Yeah. So the reason I really like storage is because it's a hyper-localized business. Typically with 60 to 90% of our customer base comes from a 3 to 5 mile radius from around our self-storage facility. So what we do is we support a lot of these volunteer organizations and charity organizations in the local community that impact just kind of that 3 to 5 mile radius. So working with police departments for school drives and food drives, working with fire departments for giving free units for people that have lost their house to fires. We sponsor Little League teams. We help battered women shelters, all within the local community, because these are the people that are supporting our business. They're the ones that are helping us make a profit. We want to give back to those that are supporting us as well.
Right, man. That's fantastic. Fernando, if our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I know this is a weird thing to do, but just give me a call or shoot me a text message. My cell phone number is area code 630-408-8090. 630-408-8090.
Perfect. Fernando, thanks so much for your time today. I do appreciate it. This was great.
Yeah, thanks, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.